Everybody. Hi. Thank you all for coming down on this cold Ottawa night to join us and our panel of experts. My name is Alec McKenzie. I'm a clinician scientist who works at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario here, and I've been asked to be the moderator for this evening. And there's a couple of sort of housekeeping things to mention, just to give you an outline of how it's going to work this evening. Could I just ask at the outset, I've been asked, because this is being webcast throughout the cosmos, that we need to turn off the cell phones. And by turn off, I think really not just silence, but turn it off. Otherwise, the webcasters' machines will blow up or something. So if we could have that happen, that would be great. C'est pour la plupart en anglais ce soir, mais pour les raisons sont claires avec mon français. Mais si vous avez des questions ou les comments en français, nous avons ici quelques gens qui peuvent traduire pour nous. Donc les questions en français are welcome. That's enough French for me for tonight. The way it's going to work this evening is we're going to be introduced to our star-studded panel, going to have them give talks for a small period, each one, and then blinded by science, or at least sort of you'll be given time to reflect upon what you've heard by crossing over to the lobby where there is free snacks, courtesy of CIHR. Thank you very much. But unhappily, under the Stephen Harper regime, we can edit that out of the webinar. There is no alcohol. There's a cash bar, but no free alcohol. And then at that time, you're more than welcome to give us questions on writing or think of the questions. We'll reconvene after about 15 to 20 minutes, and for what we hope is an animated discussion. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce to these impressive trio that we brought here. Starting with Pyrrhin Wong-Rieger, who is long before orphan disease was glamorous, she was there for the last two decades working on orphan disease. We were saying just earlier, it seems right now we might be at a tipping point where really it's getting national attention, but it's been 20 years that Durhan has worked because of initially personal involvement, and she's moved on to professional involvement. She's a member of a number of organizations, and it seems to be the singular fact about all the organizations she's a member of, she's the CEO, which I think is a bit of a reflection. So whether it be the Institute for Optimizing Health Outcomes or the Canadian Organization of Rare Diseases, Durhan has served as a very active, voluble, and articulate proponent for orphan diseases. So we're really thrilled to have you here this evening. Kim Boycott, I perhaps know best, as I've been able to watch her from her PhD, MD, PhD in Calgary, 3 or 4 years ago, was it now?
Thank you very much.
Where she has did seminal work in cloning of various retinal disorders and has moved on in the last 3 to 4 years to really become not only a national but an international leader in the art of cloning rare diseases. There really is no place that does it better than Canada, and Kim is in charge of this initiative. So we're thrilled that my office neighbor at CHEO is here tonight to tell us about her exciting work and the implications for orphan diseases. And then last but certainly not least, we have Matthew, who is a law professor embedded in the Faculty of Medicine in Dalhousie. He started off initially doing an honors bachelor's in science in Memorial, but then moved over to the dark side of law, getting, at last count, 36 degrees, I think, in various law things. At least two masters, one in Stanford and one in, was it Toronto?
Or
Dalhousie. He, if I can encapsulate his raison d'etre, the last two decades has witnessed an emerging commercialization and interest in translation, and which I think is an admirable thing within the academic scientific community. Matthew is really one of the only ones to ask what impact does this have on the science practice of individual researchers. So I will be delighted to hear observations on that and other sort of larger ethical questions around orphan diseases. So without further ado, I think, Kim, you're the first up to...
No, you, sir.
We're in trouble. Also very deferential. I think this is real science.
We're in trouble all day.
Okay. So I'll talk about some science first, and then we'll pass it over to you to give the patient context. So I'm a clinician investigator at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario, as Alex said, and I've been there for a few years. And one of my interests, all the way now through graduate school, medical school, and up until now, has been in identifying genes and understanding the disease mechanism for rare disorders. My particular area of interest is rare neurological disorders. And I come at this from the perspective of a clinician who sees families in clinic who are looking for an answer as to why this is happening or has happened to their family. And it's a very frustrating experience if we're not able to give them an accurate answer. So I'm going to just tell you a little bit about our current research. So for about the last 9 months, we have been from Ottawa leading a pan-Canadian project on called FORGE, which is Finding of Rare Disease Genes in Canada, that it connects our 21 genetic sites across the country and is taking all of these resources with clinicians and putting them together with our internationally recognized scientists and identifying genes. So prior to this, and when I was a graduate student, it could take up to 10 years to identify one gene for a rare disorder. And there are probably 8,000 to 10,000 rare genetic disorders. So the pace was very, very frustratingly slow for families. About two and a half years ago, this new technology called next generation sequencing, it sort of sounds a bit like Star Trek, came along, which really revolutionized the way that we can study rare disorders. And this sort of very fancy sequencing has become available so that we can study really, really small families that are affected by a rare disorder, a very rare disorder where it may only affect one or two people in the whole world, and we're able to, within weeks, identify the gene for that disorder. So why is this important? We're going to have some patient context come afterwards, but first of all, for people who are also working in the clinic, this provides an accurate diagnosis for the family. It confirms for them whether or not it actually is indeed a genetic disorder. What are the risks for other people in the family to have a child with a similar thing? And what can we do about it? So while many rare genetic disorders are not treatable, families want to know for sure that you know that, in fact, is true. And then as we understand the disease mechanism going forward, we are then able to think about, with all that knowledge in hand, is there a potential way that we could offer a treatment for this family? Is there something we could do supportive? Can we understand what may happen in the future for this child, screen them appropriately? And is there a systematic way that we could look at identifying potential therapies, either looking at drugs that we could then use for this particular disorder or other things that would be done on an experimental nature? So that's the type of thing that we do. And so for the first 9 months of this project called FORGE that has been ongoing, we have studied about 30 or 35 disorders so far and identified 26 new genes. And in the 2 years of the project, we're going to study 200 rare disorders that affect children.
Okay. And just with the identification of those novel genes comes the two aspects, the ability to diagnose it for future offspring from those given children, mm-hmm. and then also the prospects of potentially therapy, I suppose, which is a harder thing to undertake, but nonetheless a step closer with the cloning. Okay. Go ahead.
So I think, as Kim says, I'll provide you with some color commentary, I guess, about specific rare disorders and why certainly we are so very, very excited about the research initiatives that are taking place certainly worldwide, but certainly now taking place in Canada. But let me back up half a step, because we are really very excited with the kind of work that certainly Kim is doing and that some of the other research laboratories in Canada are doing. Well, I was doing a brief interview for CBC this morning, and the interviewer asked me a very important question there. He says, why, with all of the research capacity that we have in Canada, why aren't we a leader in terms of research on rare disorders, and why don't we actually do any research into therapies for rare disorders? And I think that really is a matter of, is there funding? Has there been an emphasis? Because we do have capacity, but if your researchers aren't getting the kinds of grants that they need in order to do their research, when you get researchers like him, they'll do something else. Well, Kim didn't, but other people will do something else, where there is monies. And I think it's very important that for the very first time, CIHR is now sponsoring a research competition just for rare disorders. And we're very hopeful that they're going to actually announce the winners of that competition very, very shortly at the beginning of this year. So this will be, I think, a huge benefit in terms of stimulating rare disease research in Canada, because as you heard from what Kim was saying, we do have a lot of capacity here in Canada. And the international community has actually been looking at Canada for many years and saying, quite frankly, why aren't you doing your share? And we remember back in the mid-90s when Canada was grappling also with the other half of that research in terms of development for therapies, and that is in the U.S. back in 1983, if you think this has been that long ago, they put forth the first Orphan Drug Act, which was specifically to stimulate research into development of therapies for rare disorders. Because the numbers are small, the research is very expensive, companies actually, or researchers, would actually start the research, but they'd have to abandon it because they really recognize that they never would be able to recoup a profit from it. There just aren't enough patients that are going to be able to actually afford and pay for those diseases. So the U.S. specifically put together an act that would support that kind of research and development. And as we all like to say, before 1983, in the decade, 10 years before 1983, there were 10 drugs for rare disorders that were found in that decade. Since 1983, there have been almost 400 therapies brought to market and more than 2,000 drugs that are actually registered and in development. And that means that we've got tens of millions of patients that are benefiting from that. And now, in Canada, we are very close to having an orphan drug, at least a regulatory framework, which again will allow our researchers to do that. But let me just give you a couple very quick little snapshots in terms of diseases and what we're talking about. Some of them that you will know of and some of them that you probably don't. And I think, as Kim explained it, about 80% of these diseases have a genetic, more than 50% certainly have a genetic component to them. But close to 80% will have some kind of a genetically modifiable concern to them. The interesting thing to know is that having identified the gene, we used to, and I can remember my first work with, at that time, with hemophilia, a lot of excitement in the patient populations because the belief was you identified the gene, you could actually modify the gene and actually cure the disease. And what we now know some 30 years later, it's not that easy to modify the gene. But having identified the gene, you can figure out what it is that's causing this disease, and then you can actually develop therapies that may be able to help that disease. One of the therapies we're very excited about right now, they're in phase two clinical trials in Winnipeg, was actually developed by a researcher in Montreal, despite the fact that we don't have that kind of support, for a disease called hypophosphatasia. It is a genetic disorder, and it's a disorder by which the patient lacks the necessary phosphate. The bones are very, very fragile. As a result, I mean, the one baby that we had that was one of the first patients treated, the baby was under a year old, and at that time had suffered more than 300 broken bones. Baby was so fragile that the only people that could handle this baby was the mother, because even the nurses inadvertently would just damage the bones. I mean, some of the babies are so, their bones are so thin, they don't even show up on an x-ray. This is a treatment that actually replaces the missing protein that's lacking. What they actually found then is that there's almost 100% response if, in fact, you've got the right the patient. And this baby now, who is now more than a year old and thriving. So we see those kind of, really significant. We've got other patients. I mean, I'll give you a different kind of an example at the far end, lung cancer. Now, lung cancer is one of those, cancers that, for the most part, people don't survive very long with it. I mean, most of us will have known somebody who will have been diagnosed, died of lung cancer probably within 6 months. Interestingly, there's a new therapy that is effective for only a very small portion of that lung cancer population. If you have a certain genetic defect, and that's about 3 to 5% of that lung cancer population, there's a drug that actually works for that patient population. you have to have the right genetic defect, and there's, you have to be able to get tested for it. But this will become, I mean, we have patients who have gone from being unable to actually be active and out of bed to now living almost near normal active lives. So these are the kind of things that, you know, we're looking at in terms of the research. And what we're finding is that, yes, you know, the genetics now help us to identify these diseases, making tremendous differences. And we are very excited that in Canada, one of the things that we are going to be able to do, I think with some of the things that Kim's talking about and some of the other institutes, is actually be able to advance that much more rapidly. And we're very, very excited in terms of what, certainly in terms of Canada, but for all the rare disease populations there.
Wonderful. Professor Herder, perhaps for a more nuanced philosophic view.
I'm not sure I can supply that. I'm the lawyer in the room, so I hope no one will hold that against me. It's okay if you do, though. I think the specific reason why I was asked to take part in this is that I'm part of a research group that's at Dow, also has some researchers in Montreal and in the US called Ignite. And I'm, again, the lawyer in the room within that small group that they're looking at, and they're scientists by and large who are doing work into rare disorders, Chris McMaster, and another person who actually wears a hat sort of similar to mine in bioethics, but he's also a pediatric oncologist, Conrad Fernandez. So he looks at a range of ethical and legal issues connected to rare diseases. But my involvement in that project is actually kind of limited. What I'm doing is looking at some of the things that Durhane already mentioned. So there's certain countries in the world that have policies or laws in place that are trying to encourage or provide more of a stimulus for research into these rare disorders, like the Orphan Drug Act in the US. And I'm trying to evaluate, does Canada need a similar policy to encourage that kind of research? What are the advantages of putting that kind of legislation in place? Certainly it's a good thing that there are more drugs that have come on stream since the advent of that act in the States. How affordable are those medications? So there are other questions we might want to ask around those kinds of tools that we could use, other kinds of incentives that might achieve the same thing while actually having some kind of price control that might be a good thing given our healthcare system in Canada, given concerns around sustainability and so on. So I'm looking at what can we do in terms of policy to encourage this kind of research, but still achieving goals of sustainability, balancing those with goals of access on the other hand. The rest of my research is not tied to rare diseases or disorders specifically, but I think it relates to it, and I'm excited about rare diseases for a couple of reasons that I'll mention in a moment. But I guess I would talk about my research as being about the architecture of innovation. So what are the, I've already mentioned laws and policies that try and encourage research. There are also laws that regulate what drugs can go on the market and be sold and consumed by Canadians because we deem them to be safe and effective. How do those laws work? How do those standards get applied and crafted by government officials in different countries to make sure that Canadians aren't harmed? And how do other parts of the innovation system, like intellectual property rights, which is probably the area near and dearest to my heart, how do those kinds of rights interact with those regulatory systems? So does a patent or another kind of intellectual property right like a trade secret prevent regulators from sharing information that might help doctors be more informed about the safety and efficacy of the drugs that they might ultimately prescribe to their patients? Or do those intellectual property rights in fact limit that kind of information exchange? Is that a good or a bad thing? Should we shift policy so that there should be more transparency? A project that I'm right in the middle of right now is actually looking at medications that have been approved in the US by the Food and Drug Administration and the European Medicines Agency that have orphan designations, so jurisdictions that actually have some kind of legal regime with extra incentives to do research into rare diseases. They get fast-tracked through the approval process a lot of the time. But those different regulators sometimes come up with different answers as to whether we're going to allow them to go on the market, whether we're going to limit them to certain populations of patients or allow them for a bigger group. How do they come up with those different answers theoretically on the basis of the same scientific evidence? It's actually really hard to tell. So I looked at the last 10 years of orphan drugs that were approved in those two places, and of 37 orphan drugs that are in common in Europe and the US, about half of them, they actually got different approvals. And it's not clear when I ask my scientific colleagues to make sense of the evidence base that we can tell from the outside looking in they were using, why they came to different answers. There's probably more information that's there, but intellectual property rights are preventing them from being more forthcoming. That's a problem in Canada as well. So those kinds of checks and balances that we need to make sense, we need to think about a lot, especially as we're learning with, in the area, in the post-Human Genome Project kind of time, how complicated the biology of a lot of these diseases are. More and more information sharing needs to occur. Are intellectual property rights interfering with that? So that, those are the kinds of research questions I'm interested in. I imagine there are a whole bunch of other ethical and legal questions you might have around this issue, and I'm happy to entertain those as well.
Wonderful. I suppose the whole issue extends beyond the grows of academe into industry, where there's a strong sense that there's enormous repositories of data which may be utilized only partially, and which a specific orphan disease question can be asked of, but right now we can't or not being allowed to.
Yeah, I think that was one thing I forgot to say in my little intro. I'm really excited about rare disease because I think there are some really disruptive business models and collaborations that are going on between academia and industry that are quite different from what's happened in the past. So I think actually research and how researchers and private companies are collaborating might inform other areas of drug development. We hear a lot about personalized medicine as well. So there are a lot of insights that might be drawn from the really disruptive business models that are happening in the rare disease research space right now.
And certainly, if I could use my moderator right to just say a step we made in studying a disease called spinal muscular atrophy happened very rapidly working with Johnson & Johnson, of all people, in San Diego, who gave us information within the space of 2 weeks, which was a central insight. So there can be a good flip side to that if we work in that direction. That's a wonderful setup. And now, having sort of gotten into it like this, we're going to pause and have you formulate questions, either verbally or those that are would like to hand them in by writing, either myself or Peter. Can you just raise your hand back there? One of us would be happy to take your questions. But also, there are nibbles across the way as well as a bar. So I think we're going to sort of pause for 15 minutes or so. And at the same time, there's swag. It's like loot bags, Peter, that basically there are some pamphlets that just show what CIHR and Health Canada, and thanks to CIHR, who are our hosts, by the way, and Etienne Michet and Maïs, who are here, there are some information on some of the work that they're doing. And as well, there's a survey that you're to fill out to say what a wonderful moderator I am. and how you can say whatever you want about the panel. But there's also a survey to fill out at the end.
Let's go on.
So you can stop the ballot box. So let's reconvene in about 15 minutes or so with the questions. But by all means, there's food across the way as well as a bar. Okay. Yeah, but we're back. Hi, everybody. As our very kind host, is Avram, I believe, who's our host, said there's tons of food there, so if the questions go off the pace, et cetera, feel free to come and go to get the nibbles that exist there. But I've got one written question. I don't know, Peter, if you've got some others. Okay, but if there are questions that we can start with, we'd be happy to take them. And if there's not, we can all go home.
During the presentation, I had heard briefly mention of a regulatory framework. I was actually curious. I actually work in Health Canada, just in terms of how far along that is and what your actual kind of aim in terms of incorporating this type of research into the regulatory framework.
Right, and I've been told to repeat the questions for the web. So the question is, the questioner had heard the phrase regulatory framework, and he was wondering about the nature and the timeline for that regulatory framework. Gerhan, this sounds like something that's perhaps in your wheelhouse, and I don't know if Matthew as well has something to add, but do you know where things are now?
Yeah, I'd be happy to start. We are very excited with, I think, where Health Canada an Orphan Drugs Act.
The Orphan Drugs Act, the regulatory framework that they've gotten,
very much mimics what is in the European Union. So it will identify rare diseases as those affecting fewer than 1 in 2,000. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason was that so we can be compatible with any kind of submissions that are taking place. We have had, they've had consultations on that starting the previous October, previous January. It is, I think, from the feedback that was given at the consultations, I think all the stakeholders were pretty much on board. The parts of it that probably will not be written in early on are the market incentives, the exclusivity, and the extra patent protection. But we think those actually will become part of it. But other than that, it provides for the support in terms of research and development, the consultation around clinical trials and the setup there in terms of outcomes, et cetera. So if this happens the way it is proposed, what could happen for Canada, which is very exciting for us in the rare disease community, is that when a researcher or company goes to file for an orphan designation, right now they can do one designation in both the U.S. and Europe because they've agreed that they will use a common form. And when they go for submission, they can submit at the same time. Right now in Canada, as you know, it will oftentimes be many years after U.S. or Europe has approved an orphan drug before they come to Canada, if they come to Canada. 53% of them never come to Canada. We're hoping, and I say this very optimistically, that this regulatory framework could be in place by the end of this year. What it really will take are two things. One is obviously the support from the parliamentarians to really put the to say, yes, we think this is important, and that's why we are going back on Rare Disease Day to meet with the parliamentarians to get that support. The other thing, obviously, I will say is from the public. If the public is aware of it, if the public supports it, that we in Canada need to be supporting the development and the entry of drugs for rare diseases, then that will be, I think, the pressure they need in order to make this happen. But we are very optimistic. It's gone from, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when we first got very active in this process to an absolutely no way, why should we bother, to sometime last year when having our discussions with the assistant deputy minister saying, like, I got 10 priorities maybe ahead of yours, to now saying, I think it's one of our top two priorities. So we're very, very hopeful. I hope I didn't say anything that was out of sort of a secret, but honestly, I go back to transparency, right? We need to know and we need to support it.
I just have to change my tape here.
So thanks for the question. I didn't even set you up.
And thanks for the sweat equity of all the work that you and your colleagues have done. Kathy.
I really can't add much to what Durhanna said. I don't have the level of information. What I can say about the consultations that she mentioned that took place last year, where parts of Health Canada was consulting with industry, patient groups, academia, a variety of different stakeholders, it was unclear to me, at least, about what form these changes, if they were to come about, were going to take. Were they going to be regulations made under the Food and Drug Act? Do we need wholesale changes to the Food and Drug Act? And that's where the people that Durhane mentioned really come into play. If it is going to be a legal change that Parliament has to speak to, then obviously it could go sideways or maybe it could get fast-tracked. It's unclear, and I don't have any information about what form they're thinking, whether they're trying to introduce it by way of soft policy and not actually change laws or make new regulations. I just don't know, and I'd like to know. So that's my push for transparency.
You'll be the first one that we'll get. When we all hear, we'll phone you at 3 in the morning and give you the news. Yes?
There doesn't seem to me to be a lot of media about rare disorders. If you agree, and if so, what do you think of that?
So the comment is that it seems to be missing in action a bit when one looks at the media, given that the numbers vary, but I think it's between 1 in 7 to 1 in 15 Canadian families are affected with orphan diseases. There seems to be an asymmetry with the amount of time, amount of profile in the media. I don't know collectively if anybody wants to take that.
Well, I don't mind starting with it. I mean, obviously, I think, as you know, media is based on kind of what they think the public wants to know, and if the public is more affected by common diseases like cancer, then that's where they'll go. I think in the recent years, we've done a lot more pushes, but unfortunately, much of it is one-offs. Mm-hmm. so that you've got a particular patient who needs access or somebody's fallen between the cracks, so you can get some rally attention around it from a compassionate point of view. But the true understanding of rare diseases, and I think as Alex said, the fact is it affects something like 1 in 10 or 1 in 12 people. So it is, I mean, in some respects, over 3 million Canadians have a rare disease. So I think, you know, it is something that collectively, and that's why CORD and Canadian Organization for Rare Disorders really is there. So we're trying to make, I think, it more more obvious. I will make one sort of a commercial here.
Sure.
Is that February the 29th,
yes,
which is a rare day, is in fact Rare Disease Day. It will be the second official Rare Disease Day. We've had one in 2008, and then we had February the 28th in between. We will have a second one. We're actually having a gala here in Ottawa. We would love to see everybody come out and support it. We're going to have, you know, an opportunity, hopefully, to profile the rare diseases, to talk about what's happening in terms of research, et cetera. And we're hoping that certain some of the people in this podium will come out and actually be a part of the speaking on this. So we really want to do as much as we can in order to raise the awareness around rare diseases, because that is, in fact, you know, from a public point of view, people need to know, and certainly from the people that are in decision-making roles, they need to really be aware that there is, in fact, a great deal of support. So I feel like we've come a long way since 10 years ago, but, you know, we're only, I would say, about 1% of where we really would like to be.
Yeah, I think the inherent heterogeneity, once you've seen a rare disease, you've seen one rare disease. You really can't generalize the way you can for HIV or prostate cancer, so there's just such a disparate knowledge sort of database to assimilate, but it's an excellent point. Yes, Libby.
Remember, the number is a made-up number, right? So it isn't like there's a God-given number that says, okay, once you've got that, yeah. The U.S. uses an absolute figure of if it affects fewer than 200,000 Americans, it's considered a rare disease, which is the equivalent of about 1 in 133 people, 1 in 1,333 people. The Europeans set a benchmark of saying 1 in 2,000. The Japanese use a fixed number, which translates to something like 1 in 2,500. So most of the world coalesces around the idea that if the disease affects or condition affects fewer than 1 in 2,000 persons worldwide, not in Canada, then it can qualify as a rare disease for the purposes of something like the Orphan Drug Act. So, I mean, 1 in 2,000 isn't really very rare. There are some diseases, I think, as Alex says and as Kim says, that we know affect maybe one family.
Yep.
There's some diseases in Canada right now that we're fighting for therapy to that we think we have about 10 patients in Canada that it affects. So some of them are very, very rare. And some people use the notion of an ultra-orphan disease that would be 1 in 10,000.
So I'd like to perhaps unfairly throw a question out to Kim. Given the rarity, the paradigm in most translational clinical medicine is doing randomized controlled trial, phase one, phase two, phase three, involving hundreds if not thousands of patients. So what happens in Gerhain's case when there are 7 children with this condition in Canada and you have a potential therapy? How do you?
I think obviously as a clinician and advocate for those families, the model has to change in terms of how we evaluate the effectiveness of a therapy. And I think once that is recognized in terms of the academic community that this cannot follow the traditional paradigm of how we would approach this, then we can actually set some national and international standards of how we approach evaluating therapies for very rare disorders.
One of the luxuries, oddly, it's a terrible inversion, but often these are fairly drastic disorders, most untreatable, many fatal. And so one can do things called natural history trials where you can actually give the therapy early on and show that the natural evolution doesn't occur.
Yeah.
Matthew, I don't know if you have anything to add.
I was just going to add, and I'll bang the transparency horse again, but so because of the difficulty of carrying out a clinical trial, given how few patients might be afflicted with a particular condition, there is that look to sort of think about clinical trials in a much more flexible way, because you have to. But then at the same time, there's the shift to we need to pay even more attention, although we should be doing this with all medications, after something gets approved for use. It gets referred to as phase four or real world drug surveillance. And that's something that's encompassed by the shift that Health Canada is certainly thinking about or has been thinking about for some time. My concern or worry would be that's great, but that can't take away from the integrity of the process before. So you can still redesign and rethink what a clinical trial looks like, but we need to have even more transparency about what conversations did you as the regulator and the company have about what endpoints, what clinical outcomes should be significant when you're dealing with a very small group of people. And so that we know that and we can evaluate that, independent researchers can evaluate that after it's approved for the market. And it's not clear to me that there's consensus that that kind of transparency will happen. Mm-hmm. So I think it's we do need to rethink what a clinical trial is or what demonstrating safety and efficacy is because of how small these patient groups are. But there have to be, on the other hand, an even greater commitment to transparency because of that flexible design, which there might not be consensus around whether that design is appropriate or not.
Yeah, I do, and I really appreciate kind of both of what Kim and Matthew are saying, but let me sort of put a different challenge out to you, especially Matthew. I mean, the same as we said, 1 in 2,000 is no God-given number. It's just a made-up number. So are clinical trials. Guess what? Clinical trials are exactly what you say. It's a consensus that this is kind of what we use, the same as 0.5, right?
Yeah.
Who cares? I mean, why is 0.5 considered significant and 0.512 is not considered significant, right? I mean, this is just a consensus. The consensus around clinical trials was actually built around certain kinds of conditions, which are much more populous conditions, so we can have 1,000 people. But it was a consensus. And quite frankly, as Kim says, it's kind of not only unfair, it actually makes no sense to apply that kind of consensual design to a rare disease.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some of the rare disease researchers will tell you, in fact, the only reason you do a randomized controlled trial, remember what it says. It says, I don't know what the answer is. My no hypothesis is, in fact, it doesn't work. It doesn't make a difference. With what Kim is talking about and with some of these genetic disorders, I know that therapy is going to work because I know what the cause is, I know what that genetic defect does, and I'm going to give the treatment that either replaces what's missing or it's going to, I know for sure it's going to work. So why on earth would I do a randomized controlled trial? In fact, as some people would say, it's unfair to even put somebody into the control group because we know it's going to work. Why on earth would I would set this up? So I think it's time for us, as you say, to rethink kind of what that consensus is, and let's come up with something that makes sense for small patient populations that's not just a, can we consider it an aberration of the clinical trials. If we were starting from square zero, what would we do to demonstrate the efficacy of a therapy that is very well characterized for a disease for which we know what the problem is and how this therapy might work? What would I need to do to demonstrate it? It's a different question than if I have no idea, let me take a guess and let me throw a bunch of people in and see who swims or who sinks.
Type 1 spinal muscular atrophy, you talk about what you know. The babies die at 6 months of this disorder. And if you go to the parents and say there's a 50% chance this treatment, which we know is going to work because it replaces SMN, won't get the treatment, that's the end of the story. The randomization is not possible. So you go with the treatment, and you show that these babies now live 4, 5, 6 years longer, and that's a perfectly acceptable result not using an RCT. But that's us talking with each other. Are there any questions out there at all? Or we can just go on for hours here. That's enough about me. What do you think about me? So, any other questions? For spinal muscular atrophy.
Why on earth would you have given him that opening? What's the matter with you?
Jeez,
yeah, we can just leave
okay,
now.
All right, yeah. In the first hour of my answer. So SMA is the pediatric version of ALS. It's unlike ALS, it's very genetically modulated. And there's a gene which is deleted in these babies. There's another gene which is almost identical to it, which doesn't make quite enough protein, and now we can, by using something called oligonucleotide, or something we found in our lab called prolactin, you can turn up this other gene to actually rescue it, we think. So this gets to another question. By the time a diagnosis...
you know he has his himself question.
It's the only way I get to talk. By the time you make a diagnosis in orphan diseases, sometimes it can be too late. And SMA is one of those disorders. And so and a lot of the orphan disorders are number. You're going to be, need to talk about newborn screening, which is, right now we look at about 32 disorders in Ontario. But SMA and others are going to have to be added to that revenue, so you can get there early.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Yes, absolutely.
I don't have a lot of clinical experience in this, but just a situation that came to a friend of mine, and it made me think, my God, maybe I would do that too. He was cancer of the lung, all right, and he's in oncology with the cancer organization here, but he's an engineer, and he dug it out somewhere. There was a drug called DSA, right, not approved in Canada, so he ordered it from China, all right, got it. And told them at the, cancer therapy, that he believed in it, and they said, you're not wrong, we just can't give it to you, right? Now, are you ready for those kinds of things happening where parents of this child they love will go to another country and say, heck with you guys, I'm going to get that drug, and I'll find somebody who will give it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What does that do legally? I mean, we need some questions for Mark here.
There's people making money, unethical people making, parents of orphan disease children, as you guys well know, are often desperate parents, and so there are therapies. The question was, this is an example of an adult with a lung cancer who had to go to China to or purchase from China a therapy which apparently may have worked that was not available in Canada. What are the ethical and legal implications of that pathway? And we can spend the rest of the evening talking about that. I just say, parenthetically, there's a huge or a significant cottage industry of not always ethical entities, be they in China or Eastern Europe, that offer stem cell or other therapies for fatal orphan diseases. And too often the families avail themselves, and too often they're not effective. But that's a personal view. I don't know, Durhane, if you have...
I mean, it goes back, I think, to what Matthew was saying, is that we need to have transparency. You need the information. I mean, so if, in fact, this is somebody who was very knowledgeable, would have looked at what clinical studies were actually done and however they were, was pretty well sure based on the information that he got, and that he got reputable information, and this may be a drug that is approved elsewhere, but thus has not come to Canada, or it's a drug that, because of the nature of the clinical trials, et cetera, is not approved. I think that's one category, right? We also have a category, as Alex alluded to, of, as I said, 53% of the drugs never make it to Canada. So you know, and these people belong to international patient communities. Yep. Right across the border, somebody's getting treatment. Yeah, of course. If it were my child and I could figure out how to do it, I'd take that child across the border and I'd get a doctor to look at him and prescribe the therapy. Yeah. Unfortunately, with rare diseases, these therapies often cost tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you also have to have a hugely independent benefactor, but that's a challenge, right? It's a difference between, as you say, what happens not just with rare disorders, but with cancers and anything else where you've got fairly unwell-documented kinds of therapies that you get a lot of testimonials about, and you're having all kinds of unproven, results. Even, as we said, remember the liberation therapy, right? I mean, this is something that may work, it may have a basis to it, but there aren't the trials around it, but there are patients who are willing to risk their lives. I mean, and part of it goes back to, where's that risk-benefit? If my risk is that I might get something that might not work, but my surety on the other side is I'm going to die, let me think about what the balance is, It may not be that big a difference in terms of what we're talking about, but I think it's having that information, getting some support in terms of, that's where your patient groups, though, can be very helpful. Because if you've got a good patient group, they're able to help vet that information, they're able to provide the advice, I think that is often helpful. And those patient groups, if they have access to good clinicians and specialists who can provide that information. But it is very much a case of saying, is that information there? How good is it? Who can help you make sure that it's good information? And the difference between a good therapy that may work versus something that is, as you say, completely not at all substantiated.
Right.
Yeah. Just to add, so medical tourism is an increasingly big concern, I think, at a number of levels. I was going to mention liberation therapy before you did, but you beat me to it. But, you know, a really good outcome we might say in that situation was that it actually encouraged a research trial to be done here because of the demand or interest in receiving those kinds of treatments. That, of course, raises a whole other set of ethical questions about, you know, did that pressure, which is very understandable, deeply human, people who are very desperate for some kind of treatment, did it jump the queue in terms of other areas of research that might also be, would have been prioritized if not for that patient group pressure? Now, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on those who want to advocate on behalf of research being done around all sorts of conditions, but if there's finite resources to draw upon, there's really troubling questions about who is determining which kinds of trials get researched first, when, to what extent, with how much money, and so on. And that's really troubling, especially with the current economy and research funding sources drying up, industry sources actually being somewhat depleted compared to the past. So it's really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I get a sense this is heading for Durhane, but just to reiterate, the question is, what's with that? Canada, the vaunted leader or world leader in the healthcare system, is really doing very poorly when it comes to orphan diseases in general, from a regulatory point of view, from a legislative point of view. What is its genesis? Is it perhaps everything's too comfortable and accessible here and people aren't fighting the way they fight elsewhere? Or is there another dynamic? And Durhane, explain all to us.
Well, let me first of all just acknowledge Maureen Smith, who's on the board of directors of the Canadian Organization for
Brain
Disorders. She's not a plant. She's actually one of our very, very best advocates. So I just wanted to acknowledge Maureen in terms of in her own right. And she's one of the people that's been out there every year with us, marching up to Parliament Hill, speaking to the MPs and rolling to say, you know, why aren't we doing something better in Canada? And I think, you know, part of it is, in fact, that, you know, Canadians are very nice people, right? We make a lot of fuss, but we don't make too much fuss.
Yeah.
I think the other challenge we do have is what Health Canada says. We got the U.S., they're doing all this, so why should we bother? And in fact, we would never be able to match their kind of resources, so let them do the hard work and we'll just kind of, you know, top up the gravy, right? It's kind of what the attitude has been up to about now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's part of it. But I also would say that we have a very good healthcare system. Nobody would deny that. If you think about our healthcare system, it actually doesn't do a whole lot for anybody that doesn't fit sort of the median norm, right?
Mm-hmm.
You think about people that live in the north, that live in outlying regions. Oh my God, that healthcare system is about as tragic as any developed country. And I mean, even we as Canadians, we don't scream. We were up there in the Arctic this past year we brought a dozen patients with rare diseases for a march into the Arctic Circle to raise awareness around rare diseases. And we're actually going to present this at our gala, so you should come to the gala. But to demonstrate what they do, including an 8-year-old boy with a rare disease and a 72-year-old grandfather, it was a marvelous experience. But what we saw there is we basically said, oh my gosh, these people are treated worse than people with rare conditions, right? So I think the challenge for us is that we have such a good norm, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't take care of what things fall outside of the norm. And maybe those of us who sit in the norm are just a little bit too comfortable that we don't want to get out of our comfort zone, you know, to say what's not happening. The same with the researchers.
Mm-hmm.
If I've got my research funding and I've got my portfolio, am I going to really raise my hand and say, geez, maybe you should take some of my research dollars and give it to this neglected area over here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's happening. So I think it's as Maureen said, it behooves us all to say we need to do more for everybody outside of that norm, whether you're in a rural area, in a northern area, whether you're really old, whether you're really, you know, sort of really desperate in terms of trying to get access to specialists that we don't have or genetic counseling. Anything that falls out of that norm, we seem to do not as good a job on.
a disproportionate number of orphan diseases falls within the purview of pediatricians and pediatrics. And we kind of suck at fighting in the alleys. I mean, when you look at the power structure of the healthcare system, internal medicine, surgery, and pediatricians, we have teddy bears, we're nice people, and so we may not do as well as by our demographics. Kim's going to change all that, by the way.
That's right.
We may not do as well by our demographics as we might. Sorry, what's your question here?
Yes, there's a quite established testing of fetus for Down syndrome. How advanced is it, or how close is it to the day when it's going to be easy for the parents or the mother to be tested for these
diseases? So the question concerned with testing of expectant mothers in one instance, in Down syndrome, as well as some other conditions such as spina bifida, it's quite well advanced now. And so how soon will that sort of technology be brought to bear on other conditions is the question. That's a very good question. I don't know, mm-hmm. Kim, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I think we can begin to speak to that. I think, screening for some of the common chromosome differences like Down syndrome and trisomy 18 and 13, which are very severe chromosome disorders, has been ongoing for many years. And that is done during pregnancy. The next wave of looking for other chromosomal disorders, which are more subtle than those, or even going to sequencing a fetus's entire genome, are probably many years away for a couple of reasons. The first is that we have to be able to interpret the test, to have a valid test that actually contains useful and very clear information. So right now, if we're looking for very small chromosome changes or looking for a genome, like small changes, is a very difficult thing to do. There's a lot we can't interpret, we don't understand. So the last thing you want to do is put a pregnant couple in some sort of uncertainty where they have to make a decision on information that's not necessarily valid. And then the next wave that will come after that will be about how do we access and deliver that kind of program within a confined health model, which would also be fairly difficult until the technology becomes significantly more cost-effective.
There's a complication emerging here, which is a bit awkward. I mean, not awkward ethically, but the reality is there are organizations, primarily in the United States, such as Council, based in California, which can test for literally hundreds of orphan diseases for expectant mothers, giving them so-called reproductive autonomy or choice about what they want to do with that pregnancy. And what we're seeing in the case of things like cystic fibrosis is that there is the choice often to terminate for a variety of these orphan disorders, which is a whole other discussion that we don't need to get in here. The reality is the numbers of the actual conditions then naturally drops off. We're seeing that to some extent with cystic fibrosis. And then in the hard calculus of small companies looking, biotech companies looking at the market, the actual market for some of these orphan diseases might actually be getting smaller because of this reality.
I just want to make a comment about something else that is, I think, a terribly missed opportunity that somewhat relates to this. And this is something that is so low tech, mm-hmm. something that's so cost effective, and again, is something that Canada does relative to the rest of the developed world so very poorly, and that is genetic counseling. Mm. You know, we don't have genetic counselors in Canada. We have very few of them. We don't actually do enough when we've identified, we know we've got a genetic condition, we've got a child, we know that it could be recessive, it could even be dominant at times. We don't actually bring in the parents, we don't talk to them about it, we don't do the exploration into the family tree to see who else might be affected. We don't do that because we don't invest in the genetics. We have genetic counselors whom I know who get trained here in Canada, even though we have very few training facilities, which is another tragedy, mm-hmm. and they have to move to the U.S. because they can't get a job here because we won't pay for genetic counselors. This is something that we could do prior mm-hmm. to even talking about having a pregnancy. So a very, very, practical thing that we could do in Canada, and yet we don't invest.
It can be complex. I mean, Kim, what's your view?
Well, I would make two comments on that. So while we are potentially, in terms of clinical genetic services, understaffed across Canada, I think and I probably have quite a bit of support for this, I think we train the best clinical geneticists and the best genetic counselors in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no doubt about that. And that's why we are absolutely marketable in any country.
Yep.
Because the training program for MDs in genetics and mm-hmm. genetic counselors, MSCs in mm-hmm. in genetics is absolutely fantastic.
This is your honorarium for these seasons. So
have some water. Less bread, I don't want it.
And so what do you think about, are we just not giving enough support for these genetic counselors within the centers?
So I think I can even give the example of the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario. So we are the Eastern Regional Genetics Program for this part of Ontario. We service about 2 million people. We see adults and children and fetuses. And we have not grown in size for almost 15 years in terms of genetic counselors.
Mm-hmm.
While we've grown in MDs and clinical geneticists, we haven't grown in terms of the support that can be provided to us through genetic counseling, and that's because I think that even at the level of the hospital, it's not recognized as something that's needed.
Just to weigh in a tiny bit about the question, I mean, it really underscores the value of genetic counseling to say that some conditions that we might be able to screen amongst newborns for, or even prenatal genetic diagnosis, there's an incredible amount of variation in the symptoms of the condition across people who are all affected by Downs, for example. So there are really big questions about whether we should be testing, and if we're going can we do so in the absence of genetic counseling if people might make poorly informed decisions about, or really important moral decisions about, the worth and nature of the lives of someone who might be born with a particular condition. So within rare diseases and even more common diseases, there can be an incredible amount of variation, as I'm sure lots of people know, and these two can speak to in much more depth than I can. But we need genetic counselors if patients and families are going to make that decision responsibly, and then if we're as a society going to fund those kinds of services, that's probably a much bigger debate that needs to occur, and even though we're testing for more and more things all the time.
Yes.
I have a question about a friend of mine who had a bad back, couldn't come to ask.
That ain't an orphan disease. Right.
But the question is that the concern that if we develop these beautiful genetic tests, at which point, and we don't have any regulations that the lady pointed out, GA having, and we don't, at which point are we exposing the population of that these tests can be well used by insurance companies?
Right, and so that's
can harm the people. So it's, I suppose, mostly legal.
Right, yeah. And so just to repeat it quickly, it's a famous and well-known question of, with all the increasing information about the human genome and the implications in health, can this information be used detrimentally by insurance companies to preempt insurance coverage?
Okay, all right,
and then we'll hear from Matthew.
So one of the things that we would like you to support, actually, I also have these supports to come out. There is, in fact, a coalition for a genetic non-discrimination bill. And this is really exactly to that point, is that we cannot discriminate against people on the basis of their genetic information. And it's being spearheaded by a number of groups, including the Canadian Organization for Rare Disorders, to try to get, I mean, in the U.S. there's a genetic non-discrimination law, but it only speaks to life insurance, to health insurance, so that you cannot be denied services. Not as relevant here, but we're talking about things like workers, et cetera, and people who may be identified with a gene defect, but have no disease themselves, who can also be discriminated against. And that was one of the issues around Huntington's, for instance. So I think the issue you're raising is hugely important. There is a movement trying to get this bill in place, and we think this would be tremendously important in terms of even people being willing to be tested and to be identified. Because some people say, I don't want to know, because once I know, I have to declare. Otherwise, I won't be able to get my insurance. So I think it's a very, very important question.
So how do we access that information on that initiative?
There's a link on our website, on the CORD website, to it, but we can also try to make it more available. But if you go to raredisorders.ca, there is actually a link to the Genetic Discrimination or Genetic Fairness Act, Genetic Non-Discrimination Act.
I can't really add much again, but I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, a former MP, Judy Wasilisalis of the NDP, actually went so far as to introduce a private member's bill about that very issue, or she was, I know there was a news report saying she was going to, I don't know if it actually occurred. So, but it's really interesting to think about putting that safeguard in place, not just to prevent abuse by insurance companies, but also as a spur to research. People who might not undergo the testing or be involved in research because they're afraid of that information being shared at a later date to their detriment.
I just wonder if there's, while we're waiting for the next question, are there people with experience with orphan disorders that they'd be willing to share with us, which might bring some light to some of the issues that we're talking about this evening? I'm sure there's a wealth of, I mean, for various reasons people came, but if anybody does have something they'd like to speak to that would help educate us. Yes?
I have a rare disease, 5 in a million, and I was very fortunate when I was a child because I was treated until the age of 18 at the Mount Jefferson Hospital. And after I turned 18, all the medication stopped.
Oh.
And the trial for me stopped. It was a pediatric trial. I was in the first one, so it was a 10-year trial. And it kept going for other children, but not for me. I was taken off the drug. And for 20 years, I was extremely ill. I was in bed.
No drug for 20 years?
Nope, no drug. They took it away from me because it was for choosing children. It wasn't for adults. But my level was zero. I was the first child in Canada to be treated, so I guess they didn't have a lot of history to base on. So for 20 years, I became more and more ill. When I was, by the age of 38, I was very ill. I was lying in bed most of the time. I started doing my own research, started writing letters to the United States and different hospitals in Canada, saying, you know, can somebody help me? I'm getting more and more ill. I think I'm going to die. Something's wrong. I'm sick all the time. I can't function. So I contacted my doctors, my pediatricians in Montreal, who I always was in touch with. And they just kept saying to me, you know, look, Maureen, we just can't get our research going. We don't have interest. There's only 5 in a million. Only a few of you who are your age, you're the eldest in Canada. We've tried to get clinical trials going, we can't get enough people. We just can't get this off the ground. Sorry, you know, just try to be well. We're just getting more and more ill. So, and people with my condition were dying. And I would read the research and I knew, like, when I would go to the medical clinic at the University of Ottawa, and the librarian thought I was a medical student. So I was in there and all this stuff, and I was doing my own work. So finally, I did hook up with a program in Toronto, and I went on the drug, and I was on the first clinical trial for adults of the drug, which always existed, but wasn't for children. And my whole life basically changed. It took 7 years to get the right dose. I was still very ill for 7 years, and it took 7 years. I got the right dose. My life is completely, I'm more healthy now at 53 than I was at 20. Wow. And I know that that's because we don't have access to research, and it has to be a trial. When you're 5 in a million, it has to be an international trial, and it's very complicated, and that's one of the reasons why I fight for people with rare diseases.
Wow. On behalf of my colleagues, sorry about those 2 decades.
Those 2 decades.
Wow, that is that's a real.
If you're waiting for another question, let me give the flip side of Maureen's story, and that is, this is actually the same drug. So quite frankly, is that this is a drug, as you said, it is approved for children, but it was approved in Canada, and the indication on the label is for people who have a low level of this particular hormone. Mm-hmm. The problem is that there are some rare conditions, in this case Prader-Willi, which is a very devastating condition, and it's, you know, usually the people would die in their early teens. Mm-hmm. It is not labeled for that particular condition because the patient population is too small. They've never tested in that patient population. Some of that population will have a low enough level of their hormone that they will qualify for the therapy under the public drug plans, but some of them will have a higher level. And yet, because they have this rare condition, they will suffer from all of the problems. In Canada, and many of the provinces, they will not pay for a drug for what they call off-label use, because it's not indicated on the label. But here's the catch-22. It has become a standard of care everywhere else in the world because it's used in normal practice. It is given in clinics. It is listed as the standard of care for this disease from, by all the specialists. So when we go to the companies and say we need to have a labeled indication, they say the only way to get a labeled indication is do a randomized controlled trial. Uh-huh. We will not do a randomized controlled trial just for Canada because it's available elsewhere. Right. And they say we actually can't do a randomized controlled trial because it's unethical. We know it works. How can we actually conceivably put people into a control group? So we can take two children with that condition. One of them is on therapy and who is actually thriving, and one of them is not on therapy, and you can physically see mm-hmm. the deterioration in this child. And yet we cannot convince our provincial drug plants to provide the therapy for this child because it is so-called an unindicated usage. It's off-label usage. This is the tragedy. And, you know, in Canada, if part of me talk about regulatory reform, the problem is we've got to change the legislation to say there's a way of getting a label change without going through an RCT. I mean, this is, again, the RCT being the gold standard. It's not always a very good gold standard when you're trying to apply it in these other situations in which it makes zero sense. So that's the flip side. It's the same therapy.
Right. I'd like to add, right. My story doesn't sound like it's all beautiful, that my drug is not covered in Ontario. It's only covered in Quebec and in BC. So I'm very fortunate that my private insurance pays for it.
Right.
But I live with that stress every time I submit it. Are they going to continue paying for it? Because they have been paying for it. So that's the other thing with rare diseases, that in Canada, where you live, is also going to have an impact on what treatment you're going to get. So.
Is yes.
Which then brings up the question, is there a possibility to get a nationwide legislation through that overrules or overrides the provincial...
welcome to Canada.
So the
question is being asked, if wishes were horses, might there be an overarching federal program which we could in one fell swoop address this moral dilemma, this egregious situation? And I imagine it's a question that has occurred to you, ladies.
We have been negotiating very heavily with the provincial governments. Mm-hmm. There was on the books in 2006, under the point, at that time when we were talking about, remember our national pharmaceutical strategy,
yes.
not so very long ago,
yes.
where we might actually have catastrophic coverage and all those other things that would go into a national FPT plan, mm-hmm. which has now been abandoned. There was, in fact, at that time, a proposal for a national program for rare disorders, recognizing, as you said, some of these issues or some of the problems in terms of where you've got, because these are genetic disorders, you will get whole groups of patients in one province, which will be a huge strain in terms of a treatment that's very expensive, et cetera. That plan was abandoned, and I'm not going to go into all the politics of why it was abandoned,
mm-hmm.
but we have very lately now gotten the provinces to come back together, speaking with the provincial drug plan managers. And we are now once again having these discussions around the possibilities of a national drug plan for rare disorders, mm-hmm. something like the Pan-Canadian organization, Pan-Canadian Oncology Drug Review mm-hmm. Program, where they would actually have one review body, where they could have guidelines. Each province would still have to pay for it separately, but that would take us a long ways. But again, it relies on people to say, yes, we would endorse that.
Political will.
Yeah, political will. So we're talking about it. It makes great sense. It's trying to make it happen, right?
Is the problem, Matthew?
To
I know he's
going to
really shoot a pin into my great balloon. I understand that. It's okay.
No, the legal barrier that I wish wasn't there, because I really believe there's a role for the federal government. And as we all know, there is, and they're actively involved in various health domains. But under the Constitution, provinces have primary jurisdiction over health, which is a major impediment to the kind of idea you're sort of imagining. There is still federal and interprovincial cooperation. The Common Drug Review shares information and helps to sort of for provinces to make decisions. But ultimately, when it comes to funding particular healthcare services,
mm-hmm.
It's usually going to be in the provincial's basket of decision making. And absent will to change mm-hmm. that, that's a real barrier to that kind of. So what he's doing in terms of lessening the amount of funding? Yeah. Well, that won't change the Constitution.
The point was Harper's opting out by my father. But there you go. Yes.
It would be interesting to see as, you know, there's less transfer payments, if that is what's in the works, whether there are creative arguments for different kinds of distributed oversight. or more creative provincial cooperation. It won't do much to change the constitution, though, and who has primary control over health matters.
So the provincial inertia that we're seeing, is it lack of knowledge, incompetence, or I mean, that maybe that's an overstatement, or these things can be bloody expensive, and so one hesitates to think it, but the fact they're not moving is a money-saving initiative, or is it clear, Durhan?
Oh, yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the will to make it happen, right? I mean, we have actually gone the route initially, right, where there was a federal component in it, and we have got some model programs in which the feds actually were a contributing partner. We have basically kind of abandoned that because the province is basically, 2006, the reason it fell apart, the Fed says, we're willing to stimulate this and to make it happen. We don't want to fund it. Mm-hmm. So the province says, well, if you don't want to fund it, we don't want to talk to each other. So then we went back to say, talk to each other anyway, because having one program would be better than you know, each jurisdiction trying to do its own. So they're now coming back together to do that. But yeah, these are very expensive therapies. Let's be very clear. Mm-hmm. They're not cheap therapies. Mm-hmm. And why they're so expensive or why they need to be expensive is a little bit aside from mm-hmm. the main question at hand. I think the provinces have now really recognized that regardless of what they say, they're going to be paying for them. When we talk about the advocacy that was asked before, the media has been strongly supportive to a good degree and are sort of making a case for these rare disorders. And, you know, in many cases, we've done the surveys with the public. The public says, yes, we support mm-hmm. that people who have rare diseases ought to get access to therapies, even though they may be quite costly. Mm-hmm. So I think they're recognizing they have to do it, and they're recognizing that there may be some cost advantages actually for them to do it together rather than for each jurisdiction to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. So I think at the end of the day, there's an economic factor there. The first barrier we had to overcome was to say, you're going to have to pay for this anyway. Mm-hmm. So suck it up. Now let's think about how you're going to do it. Yeah. So now that they've kind of recognized, okay, we're going to have to do it, what is the best way that we can do it in order to make it so that not only is it going to be, you know, more equitable, they have approved one drug now, the first drug they've approved with a national buying plan.
Okay.
This is for a very expensive rare disease, for a disease called proximal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, PNH. The mm-hmm. drug costs maybe about $500,000 a year. There are only about 10 patients in Canada that mm-hmm. have it. Ontario negotiated the deal. The deal fits for every province. They still have to pay for it separately, but it was agreed that once we negotiate the deal, it would hold for everybody. So we're hoping that at least is a starting point.
It's a case study. Yeah, great.
Can I ask myself a question?
Kim is going to ask herself a question. Okay.
See, not really. I was just going to come back to a point I think that you made, Maureen, and that is about access and the difference between the provinces. But I wanted to also make the point that access to diagnostic testing for families with rare disorders is also not the same across the country. And so in places where I practice in Ontario, I can get a test for almost anything that I need for one of my families. But if you look across Canada, we probably test for less than 5% of all genetic disorder testing that there would be available. If you send a test out to the States or to Europe, it costs thousands of dollars. In most provinces across Canada, that's not even an option for a clinical geneticist, and that family cannot get that test to have a diagnosis mm-hmm. for their child and give them all the information right. that comes with. So even at that level, which is not the same as amount of money we're talking about for therapy, but even at the level of diagnostic testing, we still don't have equal access.
And the diagnosis, even on the more drastic orphan diseases, just having the diagnosis is a huge mm-hmm. Advantage for families. Yeah. And so it really is a tragedy. So, I could go on for 3 hours about my work, but I sense that would empty the room in a hurry. Are there any other issues or questions in the assembly?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it really helped.
They have a 4-year-old now.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Well, so for those on the web, a good news story of good genetic counseling at CHEO and a genetic disease in the family, but nonetheless a healthy child based on the genetic counseling which took place. So I think, as Kim says, they're excellent counselors, but as Durhan says, not enough of them, under-resourced. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so just if I can, the mask slip, and I can just talk about my sort of compelling vision is that while Kim and others are generating novel genes on the basis of a week, it's a bit irritating. Her office is just down the hall, and every couple of days, got another gene. Congratulations. Another paper in Nature Genetics. Well done. I couldn't be an author by any chance, could I? No. At any rate, we need to talk, in addition to the diagnostics, about more generalizable therapeutics, because for individual disorders, there are, for a number of orphan diseases, specific therapies, but for the vast majority, there ain't. And this asymmetry is growing with every passing week, with every gene that Kim and her gang clones. And so what I'm doing, working with Kim, is seeing whether there are some generalizable approaches. And with the support of CIHR, among others, we had a very good international meeting this past November, bringing experts from throughout North America and Europe to talk about what we know from the common genetic orphan diseases, the cystic fibrosis and the muscular dystrophies. Can we start applying that to the rarer ones? And I think there's a collective sense of optimism that, yes, there are some general lessons learned from what we know over the past two decades so that we can go comparatively quickly in some disorders to therapies using possibly FDA-approved drugs being repurposed or other technologies. So I think that really is, I see a challenge that's going to face the field, generalizable approaches for a large number of orphan disorders. And I dedicate the last decade or two of my career in that direction. So on that self-aggrandizing note, I guess I'd just like to thank everybody for coming. Feel free to fill out the survey positively, otherwise throw it away. And I don't know, Etienne, if there's any other feedback in the web. This will be available on the web, will it? Okay. Excellent. Deleted. Okay. I'll be on the cutting room floor. I understand. Okay. Thanks to CIHR. Thanks to the panel. It was great. And thanks for coming.